Hey, and welcome to Builders, a podcast from BetaWorks Studios about the amazing people who build things. The makers and the doers, not just the talkers. The people that are helping shape the world we live in. My name is Layla Ueda, and I'll be your guide. In Builders, we bring you a diverse mix of thinkers and leaders from the startup ecosystem. All of the shows are recorded live at BetaWorks Studios, our club for builders, located in the Meatpacking District of New York City. If you want to know what a club for builders really is, just visit betaworks-studios.com to learn more. But these podcasts are a pretty good reflection of life in studios. One week, it might be a discussion on crypto. The next, on how technology is affecting music festivals. Today's episode features author Steven Johnson speaking about his new book, Farsighted, How We Make the Decisions That Matter Most. As you'll hear, this is Steven's 11th book, and he's previously written about innovation and where ideas come from, so we were super excited to have him in the space talking to our studio's members and guests. This session is basically all about how we make decisions, but concentrating on the big decisions, the important ones, what Steven would call full-spectrum decisions. He realized that there isn't really a technique or process on evaluating these decisions, so he built one. There are three steps to this process: one, mapping; two, predicting; and three, deciding. He explains some of these steps, and along the way, he has some fascinating stories. One study around how a professor tracked experts over 5 years to see if their predictions stood up.
And he had the audacity to go and check up and see how they did in terms of their forecasts 5 years later. And it turned out they did almost across the board terribly. They were worse than the proverbial dart-throwing chimp, right? You know, flipping a coin would have been a better way of predicting the future.
One of my favorite details was that the more famous the expert, there was an inverse correlation between the fame of the expert and the accuracy of their prediction. The more famous, the less accurate.
He also talks about the idea of premortems, assuming something might fail horribly and then listing why it failed. He thinks tech companies should be thinking more about this idea. If you're going to move fast and break things, what are the long-term consequences?
So that is the routine that I believe the tech companies should be doing. I think it is actually, this is something that should be built into the tech culture.
This event was organized by our friends over at the Next Big Idea Club, curated by Malcolm Gladwell, Adam Grant, Susan Cain, and Daniel Pink. The Next Big Idea Club delivers groundbreaking insights from the latest books on psychology, creativity, and business. It's helping the world's great thinkers empower doers like you. Find out more and sign up today at nextbigideaclub.com. You can also find it linked in our description box. Okay, so here's Steven Johnson, and he's introduced by Rufus Griscom from Helio. Sit tight and enjoy the episode ahead.
Hey folks, thank you all so much for coming out tonight. Some of you may remember last year we did a series of cocktails and conversations events at Soho House, which we loved. It was a great series. We're thrilled to be restarting the cocktails and conversations tradition here at BetaWorks, which is an amazing space, very conveniently about 50 feet from our desks and offices. And we're thrilled to be doing the first of these monthly events with our dear friend and sage, the amazing Steven Johnson, who cannot stop writing books. This guy, is this your 10th book, Steven?
11.
11th? Yeah. Good God. Unbelievable. And this, as you may know, Farsighted, How We Make the Decisions That Matter Most, came out on Tuesday, 2 days ago. So this is hot off the presses. Some of you may have seen the New York Times piece over the weekend. One of the reasons that we're thrilled to have Steven here for the first of these is that Steven helped us birth the Next Big Idea Club. Are there any members of the Next Big Idea Club in the room? Fantastic. To rectify the problem for those of you who didn't raise your hand of not being a member of the Next Big Idea Club, we have Eric in the back of the room. There's Eric. And we have, and many of you may have seen these guys put together these beautiful little brochures, and we have a 10% off special on the Next Big Idea Club. In Farsighted, my subtitle is The Art and Science of Making Important Decisions. Perhaps I'm going to slightly adjust your subtitle. But there are a number of examples of decisions of great international consequence and extraordinary stories. One of the most important of those decisions, I think, was the decision that Stephen and his wife made to relocate the family to Marin a few years ago. And I'm interested, which we get to towards the end of the book, and some of us here in the room who are friends of Stephen's, opposed that move. But I'm curious to know, was that part of what prompted you to research and to eventually write this?
Yes. First off, thank you, Helio and you, Rufus, for hosting this and for BetaWorks, both organizations that I've been involved with over the years. Studios is a really exciting space. It's actually my first time seeing it, and it's beautiful, and it's a great idea, I think. And the book club is fantastic as well, so do check that out. So I'm delighted to have these two companies come together for this event. It's really special. And delighted to be doing it here in New York City, where I am actually, I should say for the record, a full-time resident now, or at least a legal resident, if not entirely full-time. My wife and I went through this, who should be here any minute now, went through this process, and she will have her own version of this story, no doubt. About really 8 years ago, I started, having lived in New York for 20 years, I started to feel like I needed to spend some of my life in California. And it was one of these kinds of situations that Farsight is really about, where there are so many variables involved in that kind of choice, right? When you think about, like, should you move from one state to another, from the city to the suburbs, right? You just think of the list of, in the book I call these full spectrum decisions, because they involve so many different parts of the spectrum of human experience, right? What are the schools going to be like? What are the economics of the move? Am I a car-centric person, or am I a sidewalk-centric person? How important are my friends? How important are restaurants? All the things that, you know, some of them very important, some of them less important, but all those things feed into a choice like that. And we went through this process of trying to decide, and we did move for a while, and then we mostly moved back. But I realized at the time that we didn't really have a technique. We didn't have a set of strategies for making a choice like that. And that did, in fact, get me more than 8 years ago initially thinking about the experience of making complex long-term decisions, both intimate personal decisions, but also broader either business decisions or governmental decisions or technological decisions and so on. And the funny thing about this book is that this appropriately enough, I guess, for a book about long-term decisions, it has had the longest incubation period of any of my books. So I started taking notes on this book 8 years ago. And in that time period, like, wrote, whatever, four other books, but always had this one kind of in the background. And it was the hardest book of any of them to write. But here we are, and it's done.
And so will you now finally acknowledge that this was a misguided plan to move to Marin? Or how do we, before Stephen's wife gets here, I think we can cover
this. Oh, she's here.
Okay. There she is. Okay, all right. Yeah, yes. I think she's very interested in your response.
I think we both would agree that it was, oh my God, this is getting so personal so quickly. I think part of the issue with these kinds of decisions is that I got very wrapped up in the idea that it was a good decision and had totally convinced myself that it was the right thing to do. And I think in the long run, it probably was the right thing to do, but there were a lot of factors that I basically, you know, wouldn't allow myself to even contemplate. There were real factors that I should have been smart enough or farsighted enough to kind of recognize. My dad was much better, and Lexi was much better at thinking about the downsides or the problems that would come up, whereas I was like, this is what has to happen. And that is actually a lot of the strategies that the book talks about are strategies of getting around that kind of overconfidence and confirmation bias that plagued so many complex decisions, where you get convinced that this is the right path forward. And in a weird way, you know, we can dive into this in a little more detail, but one of the paradoxical lessons of all this is that certainty is the enemy of kind of wisdom when it comes to complex decisions, right? And we talk about people being decisive, but in fact, decisiveness is greatly overrated with these kinds of choices, where really the effects are, you know, potentially 5 years, 10 years, 50 years. Decisiveness is actually the wrong way to go, because so often with these kinds of decisions, your initial impression of the situation is only a small slice of that spectrum. And so you have to go through the practice of kind of taking it apart and looking at it from different angles. And that's what I think I didn't do at the time. And it probably would have been a little bit smoother if I'd only been able to read the book Farsighted before I was making the decision. I would have some kind of time-traveling scenario there would have worked out.
Well, Alexa, it's very infrequent that any of us hear the words, "I was wrong, honey." they don't occur an awful lot in my marriage, but we got close there. But So just to establish that we need a book like this, and by the way, I say this as somebody who loves the book and has read the book. How bad are we at making decisions? I think it's interesting, first of all, just to look at the landscape of how we as humans generally approach decisions, process them, and how misguided we are. And I was struck in the early chapters by, first of all, the Professor Nutt's studies, right, about how basically most business leaders don't consider more than one alternative to the to whatever their plan of action is. And statistically, when the more alternatives you consider, the higher probability it is that you will have made a good decision. So we're basically very bad at considering alternatives.
Yeah. So the one thing I'll say to preface it is, to make choices like this, the important thing is to think of it as a process, and to think of it as a process with stages, where the stage you're in is different as the process unfolds. And instead of just being one long period of meditation or a period of no meditation where you just go with your gut. And so this guy, Professor Nutt, who is also, I believe, one of the characters on Clue, he's kind of like the Darwin of business decisions, right? And he in his career, I think he's retired now, but he analyzed hundreds of decisions that businesses made and both looked at the process that they used or the lack of a process that they used to make the decision, and then went back and looked at the outcomes, which is really actually important to find out, did it turn out well, or did you decide that ultimately that was the wrong choice? And what he found was, as you said, is that there were a very small number of the decision makers included a step in the process where they actively sought out other alternatives. So almost all the decisions that most people did were basically structured as what Nutt calls whether or not decisions, right? There's one option on the table, and it's just, should we do this or not? And what he found was those decisions were much more likely to be deemed failures in the end, whereas the small subset of decision makers that actually spent time at the beginning saying, hey, you know, what other options are there? And let's contemplate, you know, three or four different options. Let's turn this from a whether or not decision into a which one decision. Those had a significant, something like a 30 or 40% increase in the likelihood of there being successes. And so that's the initial phase in the kind of deciding process for these kinds of choices is, in the book, I call it mapping, right? And that's the phase that is also sometimes called the divergent stage, where you are trying to multiply your options. You're trying to conjure up as many kind of variables or factors to try and understand the full complexity of the choice that you're facing, both in terms of what are the kind of causes or potential downstream effects of it, and also what are the options that are available. And you're not deciding at that point. You're deliberately, you know, you're in almost a kind of a brainstorming stage where you're trying to come up with different options. And you're supposed to be very open to kind of new possibilities at that stage. And at that stage, one of the key things, and this is a major theme of the book, is the importance of diversity and diverse perspectives in helping you see all those new variables, anticipate these new potential options, putting them on the table. There is an endless body of research that shows that diverse groups make smarter decisions, are more original in their thinking. Diversity measured in terms of ethnic diversity, in terms of gender diversity, but also in terms of professional diversity, expertise. And so that's one of those points where you want to kind of diversify the kind of the inputs and the people around you who are helping you to make the decision. And this is by the way, this is an important political point, because when we talk about diversity in our leadership and our governance, right, we often talk about it appropriately in terms of equality of representation or our opportunity or having a seat at the table in important governmental decisions. Or having role models for success for people of different backgrounds, all of which is great and important. But there's another part of the diversity story, which is the homogeneous group, like a certain administration. I'm not going to name any names right now. We just know from the social science and from the group psychology, they will be on average much worse at making complex decisions, right? And so there's a diversity bonus that you get when you get interesting people together who come from different backgrounds.
You know, this afternoon, I set aside a little bit of time to take inventory of some of the worst decisions I've made in my life.
And that's what we're going to be talking about for the rest of the year.
Yeah, that's what it's been really interesting hearing about your book, Stephen. But we're most of them were haircuts,
or not getting a haircut,
or the absence of haircuts. Right, you witnessed those 3 years. There was an occasion when I believe I was 19 years old where I made a very serious decision to invest what was then the entirety of my life savings in the construction of a custom leather jacket. That ended up turning out like some kind of like punk Captain Kirk kind of thing, but I had very limited arm movement. It was a complete disaster, very, very traumatizing. But I should have gone through a 3-step process of first mapping all the possible uses of my $467, right? I mean, but seriously though, there are 3 steps to the process, right? There's in terms of how the book is organized. There's mapping, there's predicting phase, and then there's a deciding process. Yeah.
So, and predicting is really interesting because this is something I really hadn't thought about a lot until I actually started, diving into the book. With almost any complex decision, prediction is a key part of the art of it, right? Because you're talking about outcomes that are going to happen almost by definition in the future. And they may actually be happening 5 years or 10 years in the future or longer potentially. And so when you're choosing X over Y, when you're choosing to move to the suburbs, you're making a prediction about what that life will be like in 2 years or 5 years. And this is another part of the story that is kind of interesting about our limitations. We are really bad at predicting long-term events, particularly when there are a lot of variables. And in the book, I talk about, a lot of you probably have heard of these studies by this amazing guy, Philip Tetlock, who wrote a book called Expert Political Judgment, which was a somewhat ironic title because it was about how all these experts had terrible judgment. And what Tetlock did in this book was that he went around and interviewed all these alleged experts and pundits who would appear on talk shows and write op-eds and things like that, and asked them about future events in the field that they were especially. So if they were an international relations scholar, they would ask about, what's the state of Russia and Ukraine going to be in 5 years? If they were a specialist in economics, it would be what will be the interest rates in 5 years, whatever. And he had the audacity to go and check up and see how they did in terms of their forecasts 5 years later. And it turned out they did almost across the board terribly. They were worse than the proverbial dart-throwing chimp, right? You know, flipping a coin would have been a better way of predicting the future than listening to the people who get paid to talk about the future and consequences of global events.
One of my favorite details was that the more famous the expert, there was an inverse correlation between the fame of the expert and the accuracy of their prediction. The more famous, the less accurate.
Yeah. But he did find, so that was interesting in and of itself, but he did find that there was a subset of these folks who were often less famous, as you say, who actually were better than average. They were significantly better at predicting these future events. And he dubbed them the super forecasters. And what he found was he tried to figure out like what was different about them and their approach or their way of looking at the world. And what he found was that they had this overarching kind of property, which is they were not locked in a single way of looking at the world. They didn't have a single monolithic theory about how everything worked. They were much more inclined to be interested in lots of different things. They were eclectic and kind of diverse. It's another argument for diversity, in a sense, in one mind, right? They had an interest in lots of things. They weren't specialized. And on psychological profiles, they scored very highly on what's technically called openness to experience, but the lay word for that is basically curiosity. They were interested in new things. They would stumble across an article about something, be like, oh, I'd like to read more about that. And so the argument was that if you are actually kind of nimble and open-minded and eclectic in your worldview, you are going to be better at foreseeing events in a very complex, ever-changing world and open to kind of new possibilities or perceiving trends that might actually run counter to your master theory about how everything works. And I think that's an important lesson, for people predicting future geopolitical events, but also for all of us just thinking about our own lives, that, having that overarching theory can often get us in trouble. And even if we do have that theory, bringing in people who have other theories that challenge our assumptions is often a really important way to make those predictions more accurate.
This is great news for dilettantes everywhere.
Yes.
I can't wait to tell my brother who has a PhD in environmental science about this. One of, actually, on the subject of environmental science, there was a really interesting moment in the book where you talk about global warming and our process of addressing global warming as evidence that actually we're getting better at this process, which of course is counterintuitive to most of us because it's quite rational to feel like this is one of the most just cataclysmic errors we have made in not properly addressing the climate change, right? But you frame it kind of differently.
Well, the thing that we have to remember, and it's maybe cold comfort or hot comfort, as it were, given the nature of global warming, that what we're trying to do in thinking about climate change is something that is very hard for human beings to do, which is to think about the consequences of our actions today as they will affect the world in 20 years or 30 years or 50 years. And that is something really, truly, that human beings have never done. So human beings in the past have built institutions, built structures, built infrastructure that was designed to last for hundreds of years, certainly in the past. But there's very little history of humans actually thinking about changes that are coming based on current trends that will make the world very different in 50 years or 100 years. The analogy would be when automobiles were invented, 120 years ago, if everybody, was looking at this new contraption and they're like, oh, this is really cool. But also, I think what's going to happen in about 50 years is that these suburbs will be built now that we have cars, and it will empty out the inner city core, and we'll end up having these crime problems, and we'll be outputting carbon in the atmosphere and the climate. What no one thought like that in 1900. They just said, hey, it looks like a carriage, but without the horse. Like, that was all people could think. And now we actually have gotten better, thanks in part to computers, which we often think of as being, exacerbating short-term Twitter attention spans. Thanks to computer modeling, we can think about 100 years of climate change, and we can think about how actions we're making today, that there will be consequences from those actions that will have a lag time of decades. And we can think about how to change our behavior. I bet you a lot of people in this room make day-to-day decisions that are shaped by concerns about the amount of carbon that will be in the atmosphere in 10 years or 20 years or 30 years. That's a totally new way of thinking. And we're doing it now with artificial intelligence as well, right? There's this big debate about superintelligence that I talk about it near the end of the book, about the risk of superintelligent machines that might not be invented for another 50 years. And some people look at that and they say, why are you wasting your time? There's enough trouble as it is now just trying to fix Facebook. Like, why are you worrying about, the Terminator in 50 years? But I think that's the exercise that actually we should have been doing with social media 10 years ago. And the fact that we're trying to think about, AI right now doesn't seem all that impressive. Like, Siri can't even figure out that I'm, trying to text my wife. Like, why am I worried about superintelligence? But if we don't make those kinds of forecasts and we don't think about what those long-term effects can be, it can be, that will get us into this trouble all over again. So there's a technique. I want to make sure we cover some of the, actual kind of tricks in the book. There's a great technique that I wrote about a little bit in this Times piece this weekend that is the creation of this guy, Gary Klein, who's a psychologist. He's in, Gladwell writes about him in Blink a little bit. He came up with this technique that is this routine you do when you've almost made it to making your final choice, whether it's moving to California or launching a new product in your business, which is you've decided on path X. The last exercise you do is something that he calls a pre-mortem. And a pre-mortem is, as you can kind of guess from the name, it's the opposite of a post-mortem. A post-mortem is the patient is dead, and it's the forensic scientist's job to figure out what killed the patient. A pre-mortem is the patient is going to die, and it's your job to figure out what killed the patient. So in the decision context, it's this decision that you have decided is the way to go. In 2 years, it will prove to be a catastrophic failure. Tell the story of how that failure happened. Force yourself to imagine this narrative of why this terrible, what seemed like a brilliant decision turned out to be an awful mistake. It turns out that you get very different results from people psychologically when you phrase the question that way, right? Instead of saying, hey, you think you should go down this path, do you see any flaws in that plan? When you ask people that way, they're like, no, it looks great. It's a beautiful path. When you ask them, okay, invent the story of how this path ends up leading to disaster, they actually end up being more creative. They see flaws they wouldn't have otherwise seen. The interesting thing about this, and this is another theme that kind of runs throughout the whole book, is how much of this is a storytelling art, right? It's you're building these kind of imagined narratives in your head about how things might work out. And many times those are kind of fictional narratives, right? You're just imagining a future that may not even happen. The exercise of telling that story and of working through that kind of counterfactual scenario ends up, again, getting you outside of your tendency for confirmation bias and overconfidence and making you see the problem or the situation from new angles.
So there was no pre-mortem before moving to Marin?
Right. No, I'll tell you who was running. Well, Alexa was running a pre-mortem, and my dad was running a pre-mortem. Like, my dad, actually, the book is dedicated to my father, I should say. And in the acknowledgments, I'm like, this is from my father, master of the pre-mortem, because every single decision I've ever confronted in my life that I got his advice on, which is most of the big ones, he would say inevitably, this is a terrible, terrible mistake. Other than getting married to my wife. Last thing about this. So that is the routine that I believe the tech companies should be doing. I think it is actually, this is something that should be built into the tech culture. It's interesting thinking about a space like BetaWorks. If you are in a disruptive industry and you are messing with, for good or for bad, the ways in which people create value or share information or share their ideas, I think it is important to run the pre-mortem on new products and features. I think this is what Facebook and Twitter did not do. They were like, well, if you connect everybody, the world will be a better place, right? That was the Zuckerberg kind of motto. And they didn't take the time to be like, how could this be manipulated and abused, not just from their own standpoint as a business, but from a broader kind of social standard. If you're going to go and move facts and break things, running those pre-mortems on how things might break in unanticipated ways is ethically an exercise that I think you really should be required to do on some level.
Towards the end of the book, there's a wonderful section that talks about the this observation that this husband-wife anthropologist team made in pointing out that we take for granted that we like consuming fiction. And that, in fact, when you think about our video consumption, most of what we consume is fiction. Like, we watch, you know, all the Netflix shows and movies, and Los Angeles is built on lies, basically. And we don't think about the fact that actually, like, making a decision to fill your head with things that are not true should be, as Homo sapiens, less attractive to us than filling our heads with things that are true. And so, and they ask the question, why is this? And the conclusion they finally come to is, because fiction is a great way to basically practice decision making in a rapid, highly efficient manner through the lives of other people. I thought that was amazing and fits perfectly in my scientific studies that support the life I want to live anyway file. Makes me feel much better about my
huge file. I've seen it.
Although, bad news for everybody, it doesn't work with pulp fiction. It has to be literary fiction, right? I mean, actually, there's data around that. Like, literary fiction causes people to be better at making decisions. Right?
You're alluding to this wonderful essay by Tooby and Cosmides, who are really kind of evolutionary psychologists and anthropologists. And they're approaching it really from a, you know, it's not just today. I mean, fiction, imagined narratives is a deep part of human culture. It shows up in all human societies in some ways. So they're like, why do human beings spend so much time talking about things that aren't true? And the argument is actually weirdly related to the climate change thing. So the reason we know that climate change is real and that it's happening, and the reason why we can make reasonably accurate forecasts about what is coming is because of something called ensemble simulations, where it's why we've gotten much better at predicting weather, actually, recently, where these computers run these multiple simulations, you know, sometimes thousands or millions of simulations of this massively complex atmospheric system of weather or climate. And if they do one simulation, it's never very accurate. If they run a million simulations, they can see the broad trends and they can start to say, okay, it really does look like there's going to be a storm forming here, because 90% of the time that storm seems to form in these simulations. So by running, and actually this is true of medicine too, randomized controlled experiments are effectively parallel simulations, right? Let's give 100 doses of this drug to 100 different people and let's see what happens, and let's give a placebo to these people. And through those massive simulations, we can figure out if this is useful or not.
And by the way, I was fascinated to learn that the first randomized study was done in 1948.
Yeah.
I mean, it's amazing how long it's taken us to figure
out. Someday I'm going to write a book about things that arrived too late in human technological or scientific understanding, the bicycle and the typewriter are two examples of that, and randomized controls experiments.
And how about putting wheels on luggage?
Yeah, exactly. All right, so it's like a Seinfeld routine all of a sudden. Okay, so, but the point here is that simulations make computers and kind of scientists smarter, parallel simulations. It's very hard to do that in your own life, right? You can't run a parallel simulation where like 20 of you move to California and 20 of you don't, and you check out and see which one works. Maybe we'll be able to do that in the future in like some version of The Sims where we'll just have these versions of ourselves that will run. But in a sense, in a lower tech way, that is what narrative does. That is what fiction does. That is what I think the novel does better than any other form, in that when you dive into a richly rendered world and watch people moving around it and watch them making choices. So there's a huge theme that runs through the book. When you read Middlemarch and you look at Dorothea Brooke from the inside trying to make this incredibly challenging decision about whether she'd run off with Ladislaw or forsake her fortune, the way in which Eliot paints all the different variables from the community to the gossip to the political period at the time, all the different values that are bound up in that choice, it enables you then to see the decisions in your own life with more clarity. It gives you a kind of a practice for your own life. The closest thing to an ensemble simulation that you can have is reading 100 novels that are finally composed and show these decisions. So, and that's one of the ways in which this is really, you know, it is an art and a science. I spent a lot of time talking about kind of empirical studies, but I think that creative side of it and that narrative side of it, it's an important part of the story as well. No, by the way, I should just say, my incredibly brilliant editor, Courtney, is here, who came up with a wonderful title for the book. In 11 books, the first time anyone has ever given me an actual title that I didn't have to think of, and it's great, and I love it.
Amazing.
And she also had to suffer through the first draft of this book, which was so Middlemarch heavy, you just, like, I, you know, people are picking it up like, oh, this will help me make better decisions at work, and oh my God, what am I reading? This is someone's long-lost dissertation, you know. I'm very grateful that she didn't just, you know, throw it out and reading the first draft, because we pared it down and pushed it to the end, and now it works fine.
I love the Middlemarch chapter. So I think we're going to shift shortly to taking questions. But before we do that, one last question to which I know the answer. Should we be teaching the art and science of decision-making in school? Isn't it odd that, like, that we... And our children... I have a 13-year-old who I was talking about this book with him, and talking about how, you know, wouldn't it be useful if in school you actually were taught how to think about making decisions in your life, opposed to just sort of algebra and various things that perhaps have some utility. Yeah. He supports this idea.
Oh, that's good. We can. My 12-year-old son Dean is here actually, so yeah, we can actually ask him afterwards, or he can give a statement afterwards, Dean, if you want. Okay, no, he says no. So this is the thing that I actually became more and more. I didn't go into it thinking about this, but the more I researched and the more I wrote, and I've been thinking about it and talking about it now in the last week since this came on. I feel like decision making should be a required course in every high school in the country. There are a couple of reasons for that. The first is there is now this body of work that I think we have reason to believe that it is actually helpful. It will never give you a foolproof, you know, algorithm for making the accurate decision, the proper decision with every decision. But you can get better at it for sure using some of these techniques and strategies. So that's part of it. This is a kind of a new science, so we have knowledge that we didn't used to have before. Secondly, no matter what you do in your life, whatever career you have, or whether you have a career at all, you will benefit from making better decisions in your life, right? Those crossroads moments when, you know, it really matters. If you have a practice to make those choices better, and you've learned it, and you learned it when you're 15 or 16 or 17, that is going to help you no matter what you do. And I know sometimes people hear that and they think, well, you know, school shouldn't just be about learning useful skills. You know, school is also about discovering things you didn't know you were interested in, you know, or stumbling across something you didn't know you needed or didn't realize you were passionate about. But actually, I think this is a better way to do that than the way we traditionally organize high school curricula, because think of the course. I mean, just think about what we've talked about tonight, right? There's, you know, behavioral economics, there's, you know, cognitive psychology, there's neuroscience, there's Middlemarch, there's history, right? There's a whole range of different fields. There's a lot of stuff actually about kind of probability and risk assessment that's more almost statistical that you can use in thinking about decisions. So you would have a whole range of different fields that would shape a course on how to make better decisions. And so you'd have many opportunities to stumble and be like, oh, there's a whole section on philosophy and the utilitarians, and I think I want to be a philosopher because of that one book we read in that class. Plenty of times to be exposed to different fields and different ideas. But it would all be in the service of a skill that you would know from the outset you were going to need to use. And that, to me, feels like, in a sense, we have it organized backwards, right? It should be, these are the kinds of skills we teach. And then if you happen to develop a passion for math through that, then you can go off and take calculus. But everyone should learn how to make better decisions.
And to some degree, I think we have a culture of actually encouraging people not to go through a process to make decisions. I always thought it's ironic that, like, perhaps the two most important decisions in your life are who to marry and what career to pursue. And in both cases, the advice we get from our culture is just go with your gut. Whatever feels right, just do it. You know, and it's like, really, should there not be like a more systematic process through which we, you know, mull all these things over?
You should definitely make a big spreadsheet. That's what I tell my kids. And
Charles Darwin.
It actually begins with this. The book begins with this pros and cons list, basically, that Darwin makes in his notebooks in like 1838, right as he's in the middle of discovering natural selection. There's like a page where he leaves ruminating about the like finches, and it says not marry and marry, and it's this long list that I reproduce in the book if you'd like to read it, and it And the list is really hilarious because it's a little dated. Like, under the attributes of not marrying are things like clever conversation of men in clubs that he feels he's going to give up. In a way, I started the book with that, and then we should open it up for questions, but I started the book with that because the pros and cons list is like the one thing that we did learn, you know, like I remember my dad teaching it to me like when I was 10. So we have like this one tool that's over 200 years old, actually, because it dates back to Ben Franklin, who was the first person to write about it, actually. And other than that, we really don't generally have other strategies. And so it's like the science of making complex decisions has been stagnant for two centuries, when in fact it hasn't been stagnant, right? There's been all this work, but it's not something that is regularly taught, and it should be.
Okay, that was Stephen Johnson discussing his new book, Farsighted, How We Make the Decisions That Matter Most. If you'd like to become a member, just visit us at betaworks-studios.com. And if you're undecided, at least you have a process now on how to make great decisions, right? So you can follow Stephen on Twitter at Stephen B. Johnson. Don't forget the B. If you liked this episode, you'll probably like episode 5 on a book called New Power by Henry Timms and Jeremy Haymans. You should also check out episode 4, featuring Jaron Lanier in his new book, Why You Should Delete All of Your Social Media Accounts Right Now.
It's mankind has real problems to face.
Yeah.
And if we can't face them with collective sanity, we will die. So I view this as an existential issue.
You can listen to that episode by subscribing to Builders on iTunes and all other platforms. If you like what you hear, be sure to leave us a review. The Apple gods like that. Check back with us every Tuesday for new episodes of Builders. We can be found on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at BuildersPod. That's at BuildersPod. And also hashtag BuildersPodcast for all things Builders. If you just click on the description box, it's all linked there. Follow along with us and give us your thoughts, feedback, suggestions for the future. We definitely look forward to hearing from all of you and getting to know our listener base better. Again, check out our calendar for more talks at betaworks-studios.com. Until next time, I'm Leila Oweda. Happy building from all of us at the BetaWorks Studios team. See you soon!